Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Gareth Barlow, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 22nd of August, these are our main stories. President Biden arrives at the Hawaiian island of Maui to see the devastation caused by a recent deadly wildfire. A political row has erupted in Spain over inappropriate celebrations at the Women's World Cup final. And the people of Ecuador have voted to end oil drilling in a protected area of the Amazon rainforest. Also in this podcast...
Although I'm 61, my heart is not necessarily 61. It came out with the answer of 63.
Hear how artificial intelligence is helping us to understand how old our hearts really are. Almost 2 weeks after Hawaii suffered its worst natural disaster in the state's history, President Biden has arrived there to meet survivors of the ferocious wildfires that ripped through the town of Lahaina on the island of Maui. He's been criticised for responding too slowly to the tragedy, which has claimed at least 114 lives and destroyed hundreds of homes. More than 1,000 people are still missing. The White House said that Mr. Biden delayed his trip so as not to distract from officials and rescue teams from their search. But a local paper said the president may not be assured of a warm welcome on Maui. Just before we recorded the podcast, I spoke to our North America correspondent, Peter Bowes.
President Biden will need to answer questions directly about the speed of the federal government's response, perhaps his personal response to this tragedy as well. He was on holiday at the time, but he was widely criticised for going several days without speaking about the tragedy. And despite promising help for everyone who needs it, some local people say the federal government's pledge on this has been inadequate and uncoordinated. And he will no doubt be asked about that. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has approved more than $5.6 million in assistance. That's for 2,000 households on Maui and a one-time payment of $700 per household. That's for clothing, food, transportation, a sum of money that's been derided by many people as simply not enough.
On that basis, we're expecting President Biden to announce a further $3 million in emergency funds. And I'm interested, there's often lots of focus, Peter, in the immediate days and weeks with these disasters about how much money and support is available from the federal authorities. But do we expect that support to also be ongoing into the months and years to come?
I think it is clearly about money, and people will have questions about exactly that. But I think initially it is empathy and an understanding of their situation that people are looking for, a real practical understanding of the dire crisis that so many people are facing, the survivors, the loss of their homes, businesses, and a real fear that their town, the devastated city of Lahaina, will never be the same again, even after it's rebuilt, which will be a long time in the future. But there's real concern that its character will change and that developers will move in and change their way of life forever. And I think people are looking for a pledge that there will be local voices at the table when future big decisions are made. Native Hawaiians, I think, want these reassurances that outside corporations, for example, won't be allowed to come in and, in effect, squeeze out their local businesses. So it's more about money. It's about an understanding of their predicament.
That was Peter Bowes. The Spanish women's football team have arrived in Madrid as world champions following their 1-0 victory over England on Sunday. They've been parading the trophy through the streets of the capital, but now a row has erupted in Spain about one official that seemed to go too far as the team collected their medals back in Sydney. The Spanish FA president, Luis Rubiales, gripped the head of the star striker, Jenny Hermoso, and planted a big kiss directly on her lips. He since apologised, but many fans say it was deeply disrespectful as millions watched around the world. With more details, here's the football journalist Semra Hunter from Barcelona.
It's been a huge storm and it's really garnered a lot of speed, a lot of pace and a lot of intensity. A lot of backlash has gone his way. I think people are very embarrassed, quite frankly, by the behaviour of Luis Rubiales, who is the president of the federation. And it really has sparked an outrage, I think, in general across the board, so much so that politicians have even gotten involved and said, we demand that he explains his behavior and we also demand an apology. There was no consent. She didn't consent to being kissed. And it's a boss kissing an employee. And not just that, but publicly on the biggest stage. So yes, there was a huge amount of pressure for him to actually apologize. Otherwise, there was the thought that he would be pushed out of the job, that he would be forced to stand down, which obviously he doesn't want to do. A lot of people have been asking for him to be sacked, hence why he twisted his arm in the end and came out with that, my opinion, half-baked apology.
There is something I regret, and it was what happened between me and a player, with whom I have a fantastic relationship, just like with the others, where I have certainly made a mistake. I have to admit it, in that moment of absolute exaltation, without any bad intentions or bad faith, well, that happened. I think in a very spontaneous way, I repeat, without bad faith, we didn't understand the controversy because we saw it as something natural, normal, and as I said, with no bad faith at all.
Jenny Hermoso was speaking to one of her teammates. They were live on Instagram, and the teammate said to her, what was that all about? And she said, well, I didn't like it. But the thing is, you can't really gauge her tone if she's kind of being serious or she's kind of joking about it. And then she said, well, what was I supposed to do? And then a second incident has come out on social media as well, where the president came down into the dressing room, standing next to Jenny Hermoso, the player in question. And he says to the players, we're all going to Ibiza. Jenny and I are getting married. And it's like, what? The reason why he would say something like that is because sexism is so normalized in Spanish society. Machismo is still very much present, and women are still not treated with respect. They're not treated with equality. They're not treated with dignity. I'm generalizing here because it really has improved, but there's still a very, very long way to go. And this is just yet another example of that lack of awareness that doing and saying certain things is absolutely fundamentally not okay. I feel badly for Jenny Hermoso that if she really wasn't comfortable with it, that she doesn't feel as though there are mechanisms in place by which she can actually speak the truth and say, listen, actually, I wasn't okay with this. She really downplayed the whole thing, saying, no, it's all good. It was just a gesture between two friends. We have a great relationship. But it does speak to a much wider problem in Spanish society around sexism.
The voice there of Semra Hunter. When the people of Ecuador voted in Sunday's presidential election, they also had a say over oil drilling in a protected area of the Amazon. And they voted to put an end to it. That decision means that the state-owned oil company will now have to stop its operations in a block of Yasuni National Park, one of the world's largest biodiversity hotspots. Our South America correspondent is Katie Watson, and in the Ecuadorian capital, Quito, she told us more.
This is the culmination of years of demands for a referendum on oil exploration. It's in an area called Yasuni National Park, and it's one of the most biodiverse places in the world, home to several uncontacted indigenous populations. So this has been a real fight by climate activists. So in that sense, it's an absolute success. 59% of people said that they wanted to bring an end to exploring for oil in this area.
You may be alluded to it there, who potentially can benefit from this, these uncontacted tribes, but then also there'll be a flip side. There will surely be an impact to the economy. So how does this balance out?
That's right. I mean, Guillermo Lasso, the current president, his government has estimated it will be a loss of around $16 billion over the next two decades. There are two ways of looking at it. Yes, it's a huge success for a climate activist, for the Amazon, which, you know, there are experts saying that there's a concern that it could reach tipping point, that there's too much exploration, too much degradation of forest, and there's no way back. At the same time, Ecuador's a country that, you know, is struggling economically, and, you know, it's oil's its biggest export. So by not being able to explore, that will have an impact on the coffers here. And that's certainly been, you know, a concern. Ecuadorians are needing better opportunities, better health and education to try and combat some of the big problems that are going on here in Ecuador.
And Katie, the big vote on Sunday's ballot paper was, of course, the presidential election. Are there any results yet from that?
Yes, so Luisa Gonzalez, leftist Luisa Gonzalez, she took the most votes, around 33%, and she was then followed by Daniel Noboa, who's a businessman, and he took around 24% of the vote. So they'll be going through to a second round later in October.
Katie Watson there. For almost every day last week, global indicators recorded Jakarta as the world's most polluted city. The Indonesian capital and the surrounding area form a megapolis with a population of around 30 million people. Near Jakarta are clusters of factories and coal-fired power stations. Add to this heavy traffic, which has then made the air quality so bad that from today, thousands of civil servants will work from home for the next 2 months. It's a pilot scheme, and how much of an effect can it really have? Our reporter, Astudestra Ajinrastri, is in Jakarta and told me what it's like to live there.
From last month, it's beginning to get really bad. So when you step outside, you can feel it immediately. Like when I go to the office, for example, I would thought that maybe it's cloudy, it's about to rain, but it's not. It's actually the pollution that makes the cloud so dark and, you know, you cannot breathe easily.
This is the start of the trial, and it's 25,000 or so civil servants who will be working from home. To what degree is there hope, if any, that this might have an impact on air pollution?
Yeah, well, the government believe that working from home is one of the solution, the short-term solution. And even though we cannot see it directly, because this is still the first day of the trial, the government seems very optimistic about the solution. And it still draws many critics, especially from the environmentalists and also from other Jakartans citizens. So a lot of the critics say that it will not affect as much as to pollution, but it will definitely affect to the traffic jam that, of course, Jakarta is known for.
And that leads us nicely into the source of the pollution, because climate campaigners say that it's a high number of factories and coal-fired power stations near Jakarta that are pumping out pollution. The government says, like you alluded to, it's the traffic and it's the weather. What is the reality? Where is all of this air pollution coming from?
Right. So the Ministry of Environment and Forestry said that transportation is the main source of air pollution, which is 44% according to their research. And then it's followed by industry, about 31%, manufacturing, 10%, housing, 14%, and commercial, 1%. They also blame the pollution spike because of the dry season. And indeed, Jakarta hasn't seen rain for almost 3 months. And it is believed that is why the pollutants are still floating in the air. But it's true. A lot of the environmentalists agree that the coal emissions from the power plant is actually the biggest culprits of this pollution. The government, well, they don't really dismiss it, because President Joko Widodo in the emergency cabinet meeting also mentioned something about the power plants in Jakarta and its surrounding. But it is included in the long-term plan to deal with the pollution.
That was Astudestra Ajinrastri speaking to me from Jakarta. The police in London have been investigating thefts of gold, jewellery and gems at the British Museum since the start of the year. Officers also requested that the case should not be revealed to the public while it carried out its inquiries. One member of the staff has been sacked. Some of the stolen items were later found for sale on eBay. Meanwhile, the story has led to renewed calls in Greece for the return of the Elgin marbles, as our culture editor Katie Razzle reports.
Greek TV this weekend dominated by the thefts from the British Museum. The Greek culture minister told the BBC it raises questions about the safety and integrity of all the museum's exhibits. And she means the Parthenon sculptures or Elgin marbles. If the museum can't look after other items in the collection, suggest the Greeks, it reinforces their country's demand for the return of the classical sculptures to Athens. We still don't know what's gone missing from the museum storeroom, how many items are involved, or what's been sold online. But I understand the police were contacted in January by the museum and have since been investigating the disappearances, which date back over several years. The museum has dismissed a member of staff. He's been named as Dr. Peter Higgs, a senior curator in charge of Greek collections. The BBC haven't been able to speak to him. His son has denied his father's done anything wrong and says it isn't fair. The items are believed to include jewellery acquired in the early 19th century, amongst this collection from Charles Townley, a buyer of antiquities. One expert in recovering stolen items says speed is essential.
It is so important to have everything documented at this early stage, because we know things are being sold on eBay. We know things have already been sold on eBay. How do we get those objects back? We just can't wait for a police investigation to be completed.
I understand Scotland Yard has asked the museum not to disclose further details of what's missing at this point. However, in the coming days or weeks, the BBC expects the museum will report the losses to Interpol. Then it's likely we will know what treasures are gone.
That report by Katie Razzle. Still to come in the podcast.
We don't have enough money to afford to go home every day. We can't afford the transport cost. We want a government that knows how to treat its people properly.
We hear from the people in Zimbabwe as they head to the polls. Last year, between July and October, at least 70 children younger than five died in the Gambia in West Africa of acute kidney injuries after consuming cough syrups made in India. In October, the World Health Organization linked the deaths to the syrups, saying it found unacceptable levels of toxins in the medicines. A year later, some of the parents in the Gambia are suing local health officials and the pharmaceutical company over alleged negligence. Vinit Kare from BBC Hindi explained to Lekwesa Barak what had happened after the children's deaths.
Initially, there was a confusion as to what is really killing the children. But then you had lab tests and reports came out, and India made cough syrups allegedly contaminated with ethylene glycol and diethylene glycol were blamed. You also had the World Health Organization saying that India made cough syrups could be potentially linked to the death. And the Indian company in the center of it all denied. The Indian government said that they had tested the samples here in India. Nothing came out of it. But it's been 1 year since the start of the deaths, the beginning of the deaths in the Gambia. And the families there are demanding justice. They have approached the High Court in the Gambia and sued the Indian company and the local authorities. And I went there. They said that they would not hesitate to approach the Indian courts and the international courts. So they are looking for justice. They're demanding justice. They're blaming, of course, the frail internal health system within the Gambia, but they also are demanding justice from the Indian government, and they want the culprits to be punished so that these deaths, these cases are never repeated.
Just going back to these exact toxins. So, I mean, it's important that we stress that last year the WHO did say, and they linked the deaths to the syrups. They said that they had found unacceptable levels of toxins in the medicines. You described two of those. Just explain to the toxicity. There is a story, or you've spoken to one African family. I know we have the story on the website. What exactly does it do to the body? Why are they toxic?
So these are toxins. When they're ingested, they damage the kidneys and could lead to multi-organ failure. So especially if the victim, or if it's a child who is consuming these toxins, it could really be fatal. And as you mentioned, I spoke to families there, and one of the families, the father's name was Ebrima Sanya, and his three-year-old child, Lamin, in September last year, he fell ill, he had fever. The family took him to a doctor. The doctor prescribed medication, which included this cough syrup. And the child wasn't keen on consuming the syrup. But Ebrima told me that he forced Lamin, his three-year-old son, to consume the syrup. And this is a moment he will never forget how it all happened. And he said that he regretted forcing Lamin to consume the syrup. And within 7 days of consuming that toxin, Lamin died. So initially, his food intake reduced, his urine output reduced. And the doctors, when Lamin was taken to a doctor, the doctor told him, the family, that he had kidney issues. And as I said, the child died within 7 days. And this is the same story that you'd hear from other families as well. To see your child die in front of your eyes, you can imagine the pain these families suffered. And these are all children who could not even express to their parents, to their relatives, to anyone around them as to what they were experiencing inside their bodies. Mm. Young, from 2-month-old to 5-year-old children, and the way they died, the way they suffered, it was harrowing for these families. And that is why they are demanding justice from the Indian government and from the Gambian government as well.
Well, for their part, both Maiden Pharmaceuticals and the Indian government have denied that the deaths were the result of the children ingesting the syrups. The health minister of the Gambia did not respond to the BBC's request for an interview. Zimbabweans will go to the polls on Tuesday, but there are growing allegations of repression which is casting doubt on the credibility of the presidential election. The vote pits the incumbent and ZANU-PF party leader Emmerson Mnangagwa against the opposition leader in the form of Nelson Chamisa. Mnangagwa won a disputed election back in 2018, but has struggled to tame the country's economic problems, including over 100% inflation. Our correspondent in Zimbabwe, Shinga Nyoka, has been looking at the issues affecting voters.
It's the crack of dawn in Hopley, south of Harare, and one family is heading out to wander the streets. Nyarai Chijongwe and her young sons are searching for discarded rubbish to sell.
We started collecting plastic bottles last year when my husband lost his job. We're looking for something to do to make a living, to survive. It is not paying that much. I've tried to find manual work so that I can work for my children.
Her oldest son, 14-year-old Tinashe, jumps into the rubbish skip. He's tired and frustrated.
It hurts because my friends are going to school and I am not.
Their precarious existence reflects Zimbabwe's decades-old economic problems, including company closures. Hawkers now fill the streets, selling anything they can. Only one in four Zimbabweans has formal regulated work. But even some of those with full-time jobs are struggling. In a city park, I met a security guard who works for a large firm. He earns $50 a month and sleeps here between his night shifts. He didn't want to be identified.
We don't have enough money to afford to go home every day. We can't afford the transport cost. We want a government that knows how to treat its people properly. People are suffering.
The high cost of living and the lack of opportunities top the lists of concerns as millions of Zimbabweans go to the polls, and there's scepticism about what these elections will do for the country.
I'm not excited at all.
Why?
I think nothing changes. Nothing changes. And this is Nabasanash.
Past elections haven't changed anything. I do not have interest in them.
Leaders must fulfill their promises so that things can happen.
A new great Zimbabwe!
Nelson Chamisa leads the opposition party, the Citizens Coalition for Change. Enthusiastic supporters believe he will restore jobs and the rule of law. But the ghost of past elections lingers. Mass arrests, violence and intimidation, banned rallies and allegations of vote manipulation. Chamisa fears voters could be disenfranchised. President Mnangagwa is seeking a second term in office. He rejects the accusations of vote manipulation.
No one should come and tell us, are your elections free, fair and transparent? Nonsense! It is us who want free, fair and transparent elections for ourselves, not for anybody else.
He says he's brought infrastructural development, new roads, energy projects, and a mining and agricultural boom. But many say the benefits are yet to be felt on the ground. Back in Hopley, Nyarai has sold her plastic bottles, and she's holding wads of 100 local dollar notes, worth about 50 cents, enough to buy vegetables for the day, she says. But at last, her children can eat. She refused to talk about the elections and the impact of Zimbabwe's politics on their lives. As her family prepares to turn in for the night, Nyarai is unsure what the new day will bring and whether she'll be able to put food on the table.
That was Shingai Nyoka in Harare. After weeks of speculation, the British football team Manchester United have agreed with one of its most promising players, Mason Greenwood, that he will leave the Premier League club following its investigation into his personal life. Last year, the 21-year-old, who has also played for England, was accused of attempted rape and assault, but the charges were later dropped. As soon as the allegations surfaced online, Mason Greenwood was suspended from playing or training with Man U. The club has concluded that he didn't commit any of the offences with which he was charged, and he denies any wrongdoing. Natalie Burrell, who is from an independent Man U supporters group, welcomed the decision.
What should have happened from the start, but I'm glad it's happened now. I feel like they're listening to the voices of women, listening to the voices not just of Manchester United women, the fans, the players, but listening to the voices of all women across the world.
With more details, here's our sports correspondent, Ollie Foster.
They're under a lot of pressure, Manchester United, to come to a decision. They'd hoped to achieve that before the start of the season. You just go back to last week and the opening round of fixtures. There were protests at Old Trafford because there was every indication that Manchester United were going to reintegrate Mason Greenwood into their squad. But various female fans groups were strongly opposed to that and protested. So there was no announcement last week. Now we've had this lengthy statement of which Manchester United have talked about how they've gone about this fact-finding mission for the last 7 months since the Crown Prosecution Service dropped all charges of attempted rape, coercive and controlling behaviour and also assault against Mason Greenwood. They've said that they've had to keep a lot of it confidential to protect the continuing anonymity of the alleged victim relating to those charges. One female fans group has come out on social media, the female fans against Mason Greenwood's return, they called themselves. MUFC leadership have finally done the right thing, they say, for the wrong reasons, to save their own necks, to avoid the PR disaster. Not out of care for any of us. They have lied, backtracked and ignored us until they feared for their own reputation. Certainly, there will be relief among those fans groups that a decision has been made, but the process has dragged on for an awful long time, especially when they feared that Mason Greenwood would be reintegrated into the squad. But now we have this mutual agreement between all parties that he will continue his football career elsewhere. He still has 2 years left on his contract. It only expires in 2025. So the option will be for Manchester United to loan Mason Greenwood out or to sell him. We've still got another week or so left in the transfer window. So that's the time frame that we are dealing with.
That was Ollie Foster. A new artificial intelligence tool can reveal how much your heart may have prematurely aged because of a lack of exercise, poor diet, drinking or smoking. It's hoped its development will help find ways to reduce the risks of many age-related conditions, such as strokes. Our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh, had his heart assessed by the new tool. I asked him how it went.
It was an MRI scan, something that lots of people go through. In this case, it was looking at my beating heart and the blood vessels around it. So that's a perfectly normal thing to do. The imaginative thing that's happened is that the doctors have used artificial intelligence to compare my heart with the hearts of 5,000 completely healthy individuals of varying ages. And the AI system can see things that even the most expert cardiologist can't. So it can match the closest heart to my heart from a healthy person. Although I'm 61, my heart is not necessarily 61 because it depends on the lifestyle I've led. If I'd led a virtuous life, it would have been younger, but sadly I haven't, so it was a little bit older. It came out with the answer of 63.
I'm thinking that if you go to the gym, picking up on that virtuous lifestyle, there are many machines that purport to give you many of the stats about your body, and some of them might say your heart health. So if we've been tinkering with these kind of predictions in the past, what is AI adding to this? What is it doing that we've not been able to do before?
Well, it's doing what we've done before more accurately. If you Google, how old is my heart, You can be sent to lots of websites where you put in your risk factors, so your blood pressure, if you know it, whether you smoke and how much you smoke, the amount of exercise you do. But that's no substitute for actually having a look inside your own heart and comparing it with other people. And this research takes it a stage further. What the researchers did was looked at the people who had prematurely aged hearts and found out about their genes and their activities, and for those who had hearts that were younger than they should be. We know that exercise is good for you. We know that certain medication is good for you and diets are good for you. But it's about teasing out the precise mechanisms that enable some people to lead quite unhealthy lifestyles, but nothing seems to show, and vice versa. So by understanding the genetic mechanisms, you can maybe develop medications and other interventions that might have a big difference for those who, through no fault of their own, have premature aging, maybe because of their genes. I'm a South Asian, my origins are South Asian, so I'm more prone to diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiac diseases. So I start off at a disadvantage. So I was actually relieved that my heart age was only 2 years older than my actual age. It could have been so much worse.
So this technology very much has the capacity, the potential to reach everybody.
It does. Quite often these big breakthroughs are so expensive and so far away that you will not hear of it for a long, long time. Even though I undertook an MRI scan, which is expensive, it's quite possible to do the same with much cheaper ECGs that monitor the electrical activity, which aren't necessarily that cheap, but much cheaper than MRIs. So it is something that isn't miles away, and it's something that doesn't cost $1 million.
The BBC's Palab Ghosh. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do send us an email. The address is globalpodcasts@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, of course, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Iona Hampson. The editor, as always, Cara Martin. I'm Gareth Barlow. Until next time, goodbye.
I could feel stigma all around me.
Nearly died 3-4 times.
I had this secret.
This is Lives Less Ordinary, a podcast dedicated to remarkable personal stories.
I started having a strength in me.
Each week, we hear tales of the unexpected.
Walk in the shoes of some extraordinary people.
It's something quite wonderful.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Take on a mission to unlock the real magic of that great Coca-Cola taste, updated with a twist. New limited edition flavor Coca-Cola Ultimate has been co-created with League of Legends. Taste the plus XP and level up by serving it ice cold for maximum refreshment. Scan the QR code on the bottle for unique digital and IRL experiences. League of Legends. Coca-Cola. Try new Ultimate limited edition flavor.